For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening. I'm very happy to have with us this evening's Ancient Florence Kaplow. She's an old friend of Ancient Dragon, been here a number of times. Zenshin is a, in addition to being a Unitarian Universalist minister, she's a Dharma teacher in the Suzuki Roshi lineage, first ordained by Norman Fisher, and then given transmission by Bruce Fortin. Florence is one of the editors of a very important book for us, The Hidden Lamp, which is a collection of stories about 25 centuries of great women teachers and practitioners with modern American women commentators. It's a really wonderful source of Buddhist lore. Florence is also going to be teaching, starting next Sunday at San Francisco Zen Center, Dancing with Chronic Illness and Pain. There's an ongoing group, so you can find that online. It's an online event, and you can find it at the San Francisco Zen Center website. So thank you, Florence, for all you do and have done. So please take it away.
Good evening, everyone. And many thanks to Taigen and to Hogetsu for the invitation to speak tonight. For me, it's always a real honor to speak to you at Ancient Dragon. I feel like there's great, sincere practice happening up there in Chicago, about 2 hours north of me. I'm here in Urbana, Illinois. And I know that there are many wonderful speakers that have come through the years. I always feel like I'm in the presence of giants, not to mention Taigen and his wonderful scholarly work and teaching work. And I know that you're in the middle of a practice period focused on Hongzhi and the cultivating the empty field. And I must say, it was a little intimidating. I wanted to be in the practice period. You'll hear why that didn't end up happening for me. And so I'm not so aware of the other talks that have happened. And also, of course, Taigen is the translator of cultivating, or one of the translators of cultivating the empty field. So it's like wading into this beautiful, walking into this beautiful palace, this jeweled palace, and blundering around, maybe wearing gardening clothes or something like that. So I'm very happy, though, to be speaking with you. And this book has meant a lot to me. I don't know exactly when I first got it. It's been a long time. I noticed it says it is signed by the author. I have a feeling I might have picked it up at Zen Center, maybe in 1993, which was my first practice period there, shortly before I met Taigen. I'm not sure you were even back from Japan in my first practice period. We met shortly after that. And I have moved and been nomadic to an extraordinary degree over my adult life. And somehow, through all of those moves, cultivating the empty field, all the ways I have culled my book collections and other parts of my life, somehow cultivating the empty field has stayed with me all this time. And I think that's a testament to its beauty and power. So, and I also want to let you know that I was originally hoping to be with you tonight. I damaged my shoulder fairly seriously yesterday. I am on medication. And so apologies ahead of time for whatever happens as we're together tonight. But I really wanted to be able to speak with you and be part of this wonderful last practice period with Taigen in his current role. I'm sure he'll be back, but it's really what a wonderful thing to close out the arc of the time that Taigen has been the guiding teacher with this book, which I believe, Taigen, this was your first, wasn't this your first major book? Yeah, so that's really beautiful. It's very beautiful. I noticed it was published 33 years ago. So with that, I will dive in. So Taigen asked me for a title a few days ago, and I realized I wanted to explore one of the, I don't know if you really call them fascicles, but one of the sections. And it's the one called All Beings Are Your Ancestors. And I'm going to start by just reading it and then exploring some aspects of it. Not all of it. You could probably do multiple Dharma talks just on this one, but it really struck me. Fully appreciate the emptiness of all dharmas. Oh, and if people want to look at this, this is page 20. Then all minds are free and all dusts evaporate in the original brilliance shining everywhere. Transforming according to circumstances, meet all beings as your ancestors. This is one of the sentences I wanted to focus on. Transforming according to circumstances, meet all beings as your ancestors. Subtly illuminate all conditions, magnanimous beyond all duality. Clear and desireless, the wind in the pines and the moon in the water are content in their elements. Without minds interacting, wind and pines or moon and water do not impede one another. Essentially, you exist inside emptiness and have the capacity to respond outwardly without being annoyed. Like spring blossoming, like a mirror reflecting forms. Amid all the noise, spontaneously emerge transcendent. I'll come back to that a few times, but I just wanted to read it all the way through for you. So I wanted to start by talking a bit about ancestors. And I wanted to talk about ancestors on three levels. One is our actual biological ancestors, and then our Zen ancestors, our Dharma ancestors, and then all beings as our ancestors. So 3 weeks ago today, my own mother became an ancestor at 95. She died with me by her side. She truly made the great leap. I witnessed it. It was really impressive, actually. And I was very, very close to her. She was a single mother raising me, older mother. And I moved back to the Midwest. The only reason really that I'm here in the Midwest, I grew up in Indiana. I moved back 7 years ago when she was in her late 80s because it was really obvious that she needed me nearby. And these 7 years have been years of healing and depth and care like I could never have imagined, actually. And she taught me a lot. She taught me a lot all along, but she really taught me a lot in these 7 years, which included 4 months of the pandemic living with me so that she would be safe. And she taught me about joy in the face of adversity. She taught me about love, love that transcends even dementia and the other ravages of late old age. And it really was an honor to be with her all the way through. And years and years ago, I was spending time with a friend who was a tribal elder, spiritual elder of the Lummi Nation out in Washington State. His name was Chadis Gatum or Kenny Cooper. They have spiritual names just like we do. And he said, I remember him saying, it doesn't even matter what your relationship with your parents was like. It could have been wonderful. It could be wonderful. It could be terrible. You could have been abandoned. Many, many people in Native American communities have tremendously traumatic childhoods. But he said, it is a tremendous gift to have a living parent always. And this is something sometimes you only really understand when you no longer have a living parent. So I've been thinking about that. I was lucky. I had had this tremendous connection and love, and I know that that is not the case for everyone. Nonetheless, it is a gift. And there's a great gift, of course, that we're given, which is the gift of life. And each of our ancestors gave that gift over and over and over again so that we could be sitting here tonight. And I wanted to share, years ago, I don't remember, it might have been Norman shared this or somebody else, this fantastic sutra from the time of the Buddha. And I'm just going to read an excerpt of it. But it's the whole title is The Sutra About the Deep Kindness of Parents and the Difficulties of Repaying It. Mm-hmm. And it has a line in it that I have literally never forgotten. And this was probably close to 30 years ago that I heard it for the first time. So I thought I would. And there are parts of it, I think, that Norman didn't read that I'm going to share that really struck me as I was thinking about this talk and looked it up again. So here we go. Thus I have heard, at one time the Buddha dwelled at Shravasti in the Jeta Grove, in the garden of the benefactor of orphans and the solitary, together with a gathering of great bhikshus, 1,250 in all, and with all the bodhisattvas, 38,000 in all. Oh, so that tells you this is actually a Mahayana sutra, not a Pali one. At that time, the world-honored one led the great assembly on a walk towards the south. Suddenly, they came upon a pile of bones beside the road. The world-honored one turned to face them, placed his five limbs on the ground, and bowed respectfully. Ananda, one of my favorites, put his palms together and asked the world-honored one, "The Tathagata is the great teacher of the triple realm and the compassionate father of beings of the four kinds of births. He has the respect and reverence of the entire assembly. What is the reason that he now bows to a pile of dried bones?" The Buddha told Ananda, "Although all of you are my foremost disciples and have been members of the Sangha for a long time, you still have not achieved far-reaching understanding. This pile of bones could have belonged to my ancestors from former lives. They could have been my parents in many past lives. That is the reason I now bow to them." When Ananda heard these words, he felt a pain in his heart as if he had been stabbed and wept silently. He said to the world-honored one, "How can one repay one mother's kindness and virtue?" And this is what the Buddha, part of what the Buddha says back to him. This is the part I remember all of these decades later. "If there were a person who carries his father on his left shoulder and his mother on his right shoulder until his bones were ground to powder by their weight as they bore through to the marrow, and if that person were to circumambulate Mount Sumeru for 100,000 kalpas until the blood that flowed out from his feet covered his ankles, that person would still not have repaid the deep kindness of his parents." There's actually another line, which I didn't find in this translation, but it was like your father on your left shoulder, your mother on your right shoulder, and they're shitting down your back. Still, you could not repay the deep kindness of your parents. And I hadn't thought about this until I was working on this, but I did not come back here just out of duty or obligation or filial kindness. I came back out of love. But I think that this sutra was there in me in that decision to come back. And I love that, the Buddha, with all the stories of his leaving his family, emphasized the power of repaying parents repaying ancestors for their kindness. And I wanted to read another quote. I don't feel like I'm at the place of this quote 3 weeks after my mother died, but I love this. And it's from Thich Nhat Hanh. Maybe some of you have heard it. It's so beautiful. So, the day my mother died, I wrote in my journal, a serious misfortune of my life has arrived. This is the part that really gets me. I suffered for more than 1 year after the passing away of my mother, one of the great Dharma teachers of our world. I suffered for more than 1 year. But one night in the highlands of Vietnam, I was sleeping in the hut in my hermitage. I dreamed of my mother. I saw myself sitting with her, and we were having a wonderful talk. She looked young and beautiful, her hair flowing down. It was so pleasant to sit there and talk to her as if she had never died. When I woke up, it was about 2 in the morning, and I felt very strongly that I had never lost my mother. The impression that my mother was still with me was very clear. I understood then that the idea of having lost my mother was just an idea. It was obvious in that moment that my mother is always alive in me. I opened the door and went outside. The entire hillside was bathed in moonlight. It was a hill covered with tea plants, and my hut was set behind the temple halfway up. Walking slowly in the moonlight through the rows of tea plants, I noticed my mother was still with me. She was the moonlight, caressing me, as she had done so often, very tender, very sweet, wonderful. Each time my feet touched the earth, I knew my mother was there with me. I knew this body was not mine, but a living continuation of my mother and my father and my grandparents and great-grandparents, of all my ancestors. Those feet that I saw as my feet were actually our feet. Together, my mother and I were leaving footprints in the damp soil. From that moment on, the idea that I had lost my mother no longer existed. All I had to do was look at the palm of my hand, feel the breeze on my face or the earth under my feet to remember that my mother is always with me, available at any time. I invite you to just take a moment to look at the palm of your hand, at the lines in the palm of your hand, and consider that this hand is a gift, not only a gift from your ancestors, it is your ancestors that are with you. And as I was very impressed, Tigan, rereading your introduction, which is so beautifully written, not meaning to flatter you or anything, but it really is. And I was really struck as I was thinking about this first aspect of ancestors by this moment in Hongzhi's life that is his first big awakening moment. I'll just read it to you. So, after a few years, Hongzhi traveled to other temples. At Shangshan, Incense Mountain Temple, Hongzhi overheard a monk reciting the line from the Flower Ornament Sutra, "The eyes which our parents give us can behold 3,000 worlds." Upon hearing this, Hongzhi experienced an awakening. So I think this is very close to what I was just reading, that it's our human eyes. It's not that we need to become somehow more than human to experience the 3,000 worlds, to wake up, to walk in the jeweled palaces. It's these eyes, these hands, these feet that are the gifts from our ancestors. And then I want to talk a bit about Zen ancestors and how we are in relationship with ancestors. And I think you can't be around a Zen place for very long before beginning to get a sense of just how important ancestors are for us, maybe especially Soto Zen, actually. And I think my first experience was probably going to Green Gulch for my first practice period, where every single morning we chanted the names of the ancestors all the way to Suzuki Roshi. And even the little little dedication we just did at the end of the service is reminding us of our gratitude to our ancestors, to our spiritual ancestors. And then over time, I think for me anyway, this understanding of the ancestors has only gotten deeper than those first days of chant. And that was before we chanted women ancestors, which Norman was the person as abbot of Zen Center who brought that into the Zen Center tradition. And now it's pretty much everywhere, sometimes different lists, but that's quite wonderful. And over time, studying Keizan's transmission of the light with his beautiful stories of the ancestors, it just it started to be really clear to me, and I'm trying to figure out exactly how to say this. Maybe I'll just tell a little story. So in 2006, I was at Spirit Rock, and I was sitting a two-month silent retreat, and there's a little gratitude hut there with photographs of the teachers of the various people who teach at Spirit Rock, beautiful little octagonal building. And I started just spontaneously taking care of it, like very Zen thing, although I wasn't thinking of it that way. I would go in and sweep the leaves out of it and dust around it and just keep it nice. And it was a very joyous retreat for me with a lot of insights. And towards the end of the retreat, I was in that gratitude hut, and I thought, there is no way, actually, now, from a Dogen perspective, this wouldn't be entirely true, but there's really no way I can give back to these people who have given so much and kept these traditions alive so that I could practice this way. But I can give forward. I can open my hands and give forward. And I had sewn my robes for ordination almost 10 years before. And my life had fallen apart in various ways, and my health, and I had not ordained. And I left that retreat, and I went to meet with Norman and heard myself say, could I ordain now? Because I really understood that I really deeply wanted to give forward, pay it forward. And then, of course, with Dharma transmission, you write all the names of the ancestors, again, both men and women, on these great pieces of silk, and you become an ancestor yourself. And then, of course, eventually we die, and we are actually called an ancestor at that point, and we are one more link in this beautiful tradition that has existed for these 2,500 years. So I just wanted to say, I think that it can, as you practice, this can be an ongoing deepening, whatever that may mean for you. That was just my story. Who knows what it would be for you? And of course, Hongzhe is not a direct ancestor of us, although he's a very close, and so many of his teachings we see in Dogen as our direct ancestor. But of course, he was also the abbot of the monastery in China, where Ru Jing was the abbot at the time of Dogen, which was, I looked it up, it's interesting. So Dogen came to practice with Ru Jing at Jiangtong, which I'm probably not pronouncing right, exactly 80 years after Hongzhe died. So you think about that, that's one lifetime, one good long lifetime. and then Dogen was there. And it's no wonder that we hear the resonances and echoes of Hongzhe's teaching in Dogen. And I again wanted to read a little bit from that introduction. There's actually some stuff that I really love this, that's on devotion. It's right at the beginning of the section on the Soto context. Bomger's practice of silent illumination includes a strong, though implicit, devotional element, reverence expressed in his writings through his great appreciation of nature, and gratitude apparent in his respect for the lineage of teachers who have transmitted the practice. Especially, he venerates the great ancestors, the founding figures in the lineage who established or enriched the tradition, and to whom Huangzhi addressed some of his verses. Huangzhi's personal attitude of serving the ancestors is concretized generally in Zen temples with a daily ritual recitation of the names in the lineage reaching back to Shakyamuni Buddha. And of course, when I went to Eheiji, I learned that there's a special little place where one of the senior monks actually brings tea to Dogen every morning, all these years later, 800 years later, in an expression, a concretized, embodied expression of gratitude, and that he's still very much with us, just as Thich Nhat Hanh wrote about his mother being with him. So there is our actual physical bodies and the way that this represents our ancestors. And then our Zen practice is an embodiment of all of those ancestors, all the way back to the Buddha and the seven Buddhas before Buddha. In a way, we are them. We are not separate from them. And I just wanted, because of course I can't resist talking about a koan from the Hidden Lamp. And there's a really beautiful one that actually I think sort of brings maybe all three of these ideas, the sort of familial ancestry, the ancestry of our teachers and all beings. So I'll go on to talk about all beings, but this is one of the koans. It's called Ling Zhao's Neither Difficult Nor Easy. And some of you may know Ling Zhao was one of the members of the Pang family during the golden age of Zen, Tang Dynasty, and the whole family was awakened. And they had originally been a wealthy family, but actually Layman Pang gave away most of his possessions and they sold bamboo baskets. And they were incredibly playful with one another. If you ever think that Zen might be overly serious, go read some of the stories of the Pang family, because they had a tremendous amount of fun together. And this is one of the stories of their Zen fun. Layman Pang was sitting in his thatched cottage one day studying the sutras. This you may relate to his response, actually. "Difficult, difficult, difficult," he suddenly exclaimed, "like trying to store 10 bushels of sesame seed on the top of a tree." Have you ever had that feeling? Everything just falls out every time you try to understand what you're reading. So then Layman Pang's wife has her response. "Easy, easy, easy," his wife, Laywoman Pang, answered him. "It's like touching your feet to the floor when you get out of bed." It's kind of like the song of the grass hut that we just heard. "Neither difficult nor easy," said his daughter Ling Zhao. "It's like the teachings of the ancestors shining on the 100 grass tips." The teachings are everywhere, everywhere. And I was really intrigued, and I don't know much about this expression, the 100 grass tips, but it's actually something, let's see if I can find it here. It's something that, that Huangzhi uses the same expression. I was trying to find it. Here it is. For Huangzhi, this is from the introduction again, "the whole practice, purpose of practice is," and this is in quotes, "graciously share yourself with the 100 grass tips, i.e. myriad beings, in the busy marketplace." So so that leads me to this question of all beings. What is this? How can all beings be our ancestors? And, you know, one of the things, and I'm going to talk just, I think I'll have enough time, a little bit about this, the whole question, which I'm sure this has come up in a lot of the talks about the sort of critique of Huangzhi's teaching as quietism, as a sort of navel gazing. And I think that we can see in this element, even in that what I just read, how much that is not the case, including in the original quote that I read. But I think that this way that our ancestors are all beings, this attitude of gratitude, of reverence, of understanding that we would not be here without everything that has come before, can be expanded to all beings who are here now, that we are this inextricably bound together and often suffering realm, and that this is where we can start to develop compassion. And there's a pretty famous quote from the Dalai Lama, and I just thought I would read it to you, and you'll see the connection here. Oh, I didn't mention, I'm actually dedicating this talk to my mother, to Harriet McNeil, that is a picture of her from when she was, it's a painting of her when she was 35 years old, before I was born, playing a guitar in a garden in the city where I was born. Okay, so here's the reading from the Dalai Lama. Since the cycle of existence has no beginning, there is no sentient being we can point to and say, that person has not been my mother in the past. Not only have they been our mothers in the past, but also they will be our mothers in the future. If you are able to develop deep conviction in this fact, it will be quite easy to recollect and reflect upon their great kindness and then develop the wish to repay their kindness. And of course, the only way we can repay that kindness is through our kindness, our compassion, our open hearts towards all. So again, as I said, I really think, and I thought Taigen does a really great job of explaining how, Dahui was not really the antagonist that he's often depicted in relation to Hongzhi. But I think it is important to recognize that we have to be careful, that you can, that actually Sokhni Rinpoche, who I did a little practice with, in their tradition, the Dzogchen tradition, talks about stupid samadhi, which I just thought was like the greatest term ever. Where you're just sitting there, you're really comfortable, you know, you're not in the beginning stage where you're restless and you're going through all kinds of purification. You've gone beyond that and you're just sitting there basically blank. That is not what Hongzhi is talking about. And I loved the quote from Dahui. Let's see here. I have to find it. There's all these fancy Roman. Oh, here it is. Okay. So the way that Dahui charged that the advocates of silent illumination are just teaching people to stop and rest and play dead, to sit wordlessly with eyes shut beneath the black mountain, and don't seek subtle, wondrous enlightenment. So that is the danger. And that's something I think, that's why we have teachers, partially. That's why teachers are so important, because we can fool ourselves into thinking that we are deeply calm and realized when actually we're asleep. So I don't think this is Hongzhi's teaching. I think that it comes through that it's a tremendously dynamic and live teaching, actually, that he is bringing. But I just want to mention that, and it's not a teaching that is entirely inward. It really is about response as well. And I just, I wanted to read the original quote again so that you could remember that. Essentially, you exist inside emptiness and have the capacity to respond outwardly. It's actually from this perspective of not trying to get anything that we have the true possibility of an appropriate response, as we say in Zen. And the last few weeks, I've been thinking a lot about, it's really been on my mind, questions of compassion and what compassion is, real compassion. And there's a koan from the Blue Cliff Record. Probably some of you know it. Yunyan asked Daowu, how does Kuan Yin use all those hands and eyes? You know, the thousand arm Kuan Yin. Daowu answered, it's like feeling behind you for a pillow in the middle of the night. Just going to read that. There's more to the koan, but that line, I think, is a hint for us about how to, this is case 89, by the way, how to realize that it's not about helping others. It's about responding naturally from this place of really understanding as we sit with all beings, with the whole world moving in and out of our body, in and out of our breath, that responding is as natural as reaching behind us for a pillow for our back in the middle of the night. So I want to close with some lines from, again, from the introduction, from the end of his life, which I just thought was really great. So this is how he spent the last little time of his life. Again, hardly navel-gazing. In the autumn of 1157, Feng Zhi journeyed down the mountain for the first time in nearly 30 years, because he was 30 years at the monastery. He visited local military and government officials and lay patrons of his temple to say goodbye and thank them for their support. He returned to Jingdie Temple on November 10th, and the next morning bathed, put on fresh robes, and went to the Dharma Hall, where he gave a farewell talk to its monks. He asked his attendant for a brush and wrote a letter to his colleague and sometimes critic. I love that this is like the last thing he does, the Zen teacher Dahui, asking him to take charge of the temple. Then Feng Zhi wrote, beautiful death poem, illusory dreams, phantom flowers, 67 years, a white bird vanishes in the mist, autumn waters merge with the sky. He then passed away, as I usually do, in formal meditation posture. Thank you.